Climate change is on our minds this week, now that the U.S. and China have announced plans to curb carbon emissions by 2030. Journalist Naomi Klein has been thinking about our current approaches to global warming, and she thinks we're getting it wrong. Her new book is called This Changes Everything: Capitalism Versus the Climate. She stopped by our studios recently and told Steve Paulson that tackling climate change is more urgent than ever.
For a long time, climate change was like this grandchildren problem. But that's really changing, you know? I mean, we are experiencing the impacts of climate change in the here and now. It's gone from being this grandchildren problem to being a banging down our door problem pretty rapidly. And that is changing the discussion because of people's lived experience with extreme weather. And yet we're still denying. And I think we're denying in the sense of, looking away, right? So we're living with this cognitive dissonance of, on the one hand, being told and indeed experiencing the reality of climate change in these moments, and on the other hand, living in a culture that is sending us the opposite message through the policies that are all around us and the culture that's all around us. So we look away.
So how much urgency is there here? I mean, let's talk about possible scenarios. If the global temperature goes up 2 degrees Celsius, which is what, 3.7 degrees Fahrenheit, something like that, or 4 degrees Celsius, which is within the forecasts. What will happen?
So where we're at is we are currently on the road towards 4 to 6 degrees warming, 4 to 6 degrees Celsius. So on the high end, around 10.7 degrees Fahrenheit above pre-industrial levels. That's a lot of warming. And these projections come from very conservative institutions. This is not, you know, me and my lefty friends. This is the World Bank. This is the International Energy Agency. This is PricewaterhouseCoopers says we're on a trajectory towards 6 degrees Celsius warming. So the reason that we should be alarmed is that when our governments, including the U.S. government, went to Copenhagen in 2009, which was the last big climate summit, our governments agreed to keep warming below 2 degrees Celsius because they said anything above 2 degrees Celsius is catastrophic. And that target itself was extremely controversial. African delegates were protesting in the halls saying that this would be catastrophic for them because in sub-Saharan Africa, it would translate into warming that would be absolutely devastating because we've already increased temperatures by around 0.7 and we are already seeing the impact. So we're talking about more than doubling that. But after you go past 2 degrees warming, the climate models start to break down, really. 4 degrees, we're talking about countries disappearing. We're talking about major cities.
Because of
rising sea levels. We're talking about crop level failures of around 60%. And that's at 4 degrees. No one even bothers to try to guess what 6 degrees would look like because, things start to go nonlinear. And so if those sorts of projections are without triggering tipping points, right? Without setting off just really nonlinear reactions. And everybody agrees we do not want to be warming temperatures by 4 degrees Celsius or 6 degrees Celsius.
And our governments have agreed to it. What are the timelines right here? I mean, in terms of some of these mainstream institutions you've mentioned, the World Bank, I mean, you know, given current trends, if things don't change, you know, at what point do we hit 4 degrees warming?
Well, this is really imprecise. I mean, we don't know, but it could be as early as mid-century. It could be by end of century. The exact moment when we would hit certain temperatures, the science there is not clear enough. But what we do know is that there's a delayed response, and we have a global carbon budget. And we have already used up a whole lot of it. So we need to start scaling back because we can't just sort of slam on the brakes all at once. So this is why we need a sort of system of gradual emission reductions. And what, for instance, the Tyndall Center in Manchester, England, which is one of the leading climate change research institutions, says is that we need to be cutting our emissions by 8 to 10% a year starting now so that we aren't slamming on the brakes so quickly that we would be dealing with a massive economic crash.
8 to 10% each year. Okay. How can we do that? I mean, that sounds, you know, pretty unrealistic.
Well, first of all, those numbers are based on the global carbon budget that was produced produced by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. But the Tyndall Center researchers are also saying, okay, our governments also agreed that our approach to climate change has to be based on some sense of historical equity, in the sense that the countries that have been emitting carbon for 200 years by burning fossil fuels need to start reducing more quickly than so-called emerging markets. India and China also need to be cutting their emissions, you know, within the next decade, but they have a little bit more time to play with. So that's why we need to cut deeper, faster.
So who's responsible here? Are these decisions that have to be made at the governmental level? I mean, individual countries saying, okay, we're gonna rein in emissions.
Well, the United Nations has traditionally been the main forum in which we have developed emission reduction plans, and then countries within that framework develop their own plans for how they're going to meet their targets. So, which is to say, we need to do it all. We need to work together, because this is a truly global crisis that does not respect national boundaries. It doesn't make sense for us to only do this as individual countries. We have to come up with a plan that says, okay, we're all doing this now, because people feel helpless.
Now, one of the points that you make in your book, This Changes Everything, is that this is a historic opportunity, you know, to really shift the way the economy works. And I mean, really what you're talking about is trying to move to, I guess, what we would call a post-carbon economy. How could this be done?
So the book is making a pretty radical argument that we aren't going to do this within the confines of our current political reality. It will require a profound change, including a profound ideological shift. We've moved very far in one direction, a direction which has really vilified collective action, that has vilified intervening in the market, vilified taxation, vilified public investments. So if you're asking how we do this, we have to do all those things. I mean, we have to make the polluters pay. The money is there.
What does that mean, to make polluters pay?
Well, it would mean a variety of things. It would mean higher royalty rates on extraction of fossil fuels. It could mean higher taxes on exports of fossil fuels. It could mean luxury taxes, because the wealthiest among us are also the highest emitters. It could also mean a financial transaction tax. I mean, there's all kinds of ways of getting at that money, but all of them break the cardinal rules of, no, we're not supposed to tax. And even now in this country, when we talk about, okay, well, what policies should the environmental movement champion now? We tried cap and trade. That didn't work. Now there's a fair bit of momentum behind the idea of cap and dividend, which is the idea of putting a tax on carbon, but then returning all the money in the form of individual checks to American consumers. So the problem with that is that it's designed to be bipartisan, in that it's designed to appease this idea that there is something sinister and wrong with taxation. Mm-hmm. And it deprives the public sector of the resources needed to make this energy transition, because there have to be massive investments in public transit, massive investments in changing the energy grid, in reducing demand for fossil fuels, in redesigning our agricultural system. All of this requires public investment.
So walk me through some of these things. So you've just mentioned public transportation. So yeah, basically sort of, you know, trying to get fewer people to drive cars and instead take public transit. What else
well,
needs
to happen? Well, light rail as well is important, because a lot of people take unnecessary short haul flights because the rail system mm-hmm. has just eroded and eroded. So it's sort of reimagining transportation, redesigning our cities. It's not just about public transit. It's also about redesigning our cities in a way that commutes, long commutes, aren't less necessary, so that we live in neighborhoods where the services we need, the groceries we need, are walking distance, biking distance. And so that's how you reduce the demand, because it isn't just about sort of flipping a switch from one form of energy to another form of energy. It's also about consuming less energy. So some of that can be done with efficiency, but a lot of that has to do with just reimagining and rethinking mobility, how we get around. And the truth is, this makes us happier. I mean, people hate their commutes. So a lot of what we need to do to address climate change is going to improve our quality of life, is going to strengthen our communities. But it will mean consuming less. But one of the arguments I'm making in the book is that the ascendancy of this ideological project of market fundamentalism has eroded our communities in lots of fronts, and eroded our public institutions. So we feel the need to shop more, because we're filling a void in our lives. You know, there's been an explosion in the idea of consumption as hobby, as identity, as pastime, as holiday, that is part of this same project. So as we shift, as we strengthen the public sphere, as we strengthen communities, we don't need to fill those voids with shopping. We can shop for what we need instead of shopping as a way of life.
So you're taking on consumer capitalism here.
Yeah, I am.
Good luck. I mean, are you really?
I mean, this is why I'm honest, that this is not just about landing on the right sort of, technology and the right sort of, is it cap and dividend? Is it cap and trade?
Or is it geoengineering the climate, figuring out with some fancy new technologies to, suck out some of the CO2 emissions?
Well, I mean, I have a chapter on geoengineering in the book, and I think it's precisely because it is so hard for us to imagine the kind of political shift that's necessary to deal with this crisis, that we're in this strange state where it is easier to imagine dimming the sun than putting solar panels on people's roofs on a massive scale. It's really scary. I mean, looking at these technologies, the risks are enormous. The sort of most credible geoengineering idea is sometimes called the Pinatubo option, the idea of spraying sulfur into the stratosphere in order to mimic a volcano and sort of forcibly reduce temperatures by limiting the amount of sunlight that reaches Earth. Volcanoes have a really scary history of volcanoes of that kind because they're linked to droughts. There's lots of historical evidence that they interfere with the monsoons in Asia and Africa. A lot of the modeling is showing the same thing. So we're talking about huge gambles precisely because it is easier to imagine that than changing capitalism. And the argument I'm making is we can't change the laws of nature, but we can change the laws of our economic system.
So given all that you've said, I mean, the disaster scenario ahead of us, it would seem like it's a pretty depressing time. I mean, are you an optimist or more a pessimist?
No, I wouldn't describe myself as an optimist. I see the possibility of transformation. I have witnessed in my life moments when social movements grab the wheel of history and swerve. So long as we can imagine a non-catastrophic outcome here, so long as we can imagine that there is a possibility, I think we have a moral responsibility to fight for it. I don't see it as an odds game, like what are our percentages? If we looked at it that way, I think we'd all be depressed. I'm not saying, it's a foregone conclusion. I'm not even saying our chances are good. All I'm saying is there is still the possibility of acting with enough decisiveness to avoid those catastrophic outcomes that our scientists are warning us about. But it will take tremendous effort.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Journalist Naomi Klein talked with Steve about her latest book, This Changes Everything: Capitalism versus the Climate.